Welcome to the fourth week of our verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. I invite you to join me in Genesis chapter 4, verse number 16, where we pick up the story of Cain. Now you remember that Cain was the firstborn son of Adam and Eve. He's the first person born naturally into our world, specifically into the fallen world. He has a brother born after him named Abel. And as the two of them grow up, they have different life skills. Cain is interested in working with the ground, that is, producing grain and fruit and vegetables, while Abel is interested in taking care of sheep and raising them more than likely, not just simply for their milk or for their wool, but for their use as substitutionary atonement sacrifices, which are going to be a norm of life because of sin being in the world. But each of them offer voluntary offerings to the Lord in worship. And Cain brings some of his vegetables, some of his grain or fruit, but he comes with a bad attitude, while Abel brings a sacrifice of an animal, but he comes with a good attitude. And God warns Cain that he's got a bad attitude that needs to be fixed, or it will lead to sin taking over his life. Unfortunately, he did not listen, and he and his brother get into some sort of altercation, and Abel is killed. As Ari said, I believe it was an accident. I'm sure he intended to do him great harm, but I don't believe he intended to kill him. Which is why, when God catches up with him, he puts upon him the consequence of exile and the inability to any longer coax the earth to give him any sort of produce. And so Cain's response is grief and sorrow. He is unhappy that he will no longer be able to work with the land. He is also not happy with the fact that he is going to be exiled from the presence of the Lord, which I think is really an important clue to a later verse that we'll get to today. So keep that in the back of your mind. Cain is also concerned that his relatives, which the whole world are his close relatives, they're going to want to exact judgment upon him through execution. But God puts on him some sort of physical mark so that in the generations to come, even people that had never met him before would know that he is the Cain of the first human death that is not to be executed for that. He is only penalized with exile and wandering. This leads to Cain leaving the region immediately around his family. And my suspicion is that they're all camped out, probably made some sort of community there on the outskirts of Eden, near where the two cherubim, the four-faced, four-winged angels, are stationed with their sword to keep any of them from coming back into the barricaded Garden of Eden and eating of the Tree of Life and remaining in a sinful state for the rest of eternity. I believe, and this is only my opinion and that's all it's worth, folks, I believe that there was some sort of precursor to the Shekinah glory of God that was hovering above these two cherubim, these two angelic beings, and that it was to this place where God's glory could be seen that the community came to offer their sacrifices, came to offer their worship, and that it was from this place that Cain is now barred, and why he complained that he was now forced to leave the face of the Lord or the presence of the Lord. So verse number 16 tells us what happened next in his life. It says, then Cain went away from the presence of he who is. And for those of you that are brand new to the study, I am using the literal translation of the divine name to represent that divine name. So he who is God's divine name. So Cain went away from the presence of he who is and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Now, of course, this is reference to geography of the pre-flood world, so nobody knows 100% certain where this would have been. But the word has to do with wandering. And so he is sent into this state of wandering away from where everybody else is located in the presence of God. Then we are told, verse 17, that Cain knew his wife, so he had sexual relationships with her, and who this wife is, it's got to be a sister. And that's not a big problem. The rules against incest, that is, sexual relations with a close relative, don't show up until after the flood and in the time of Abraham, after Abraham, to the time of Jacob and Israel, the nation coming into existence. And there's a genetic reason for this. When you've got a super deep genetic pool, which would have existed at the very beginning of time, it takes a while for it to deteriorate, for mutations to creep in to the genetic code. Remember, mutations are loss of information, loss of genetic information, and that's the source of a lot of diseases and physical problems. So when the pool was deep and wide, marrying your relatives was no big deal. It's when the pool begins to get shallow and narrow that having any type of sexual relations with your near relative may reproduce this and solidify into the genetic code physical problems. This is why inbreeding, even in animals, is a very bad idea, because it weakens the kind, it weakens the group. So back at this time, no big deal. So Cain knew his wife, his sister probably. She conceived and bore Enoch. And when he built a city, he called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. This is the first time we hear about an official city being constructed. Now, what is a city? It is a group of people in very close proximity to one another, building not just simply housing, but apparently some sort of protection, sometimes a wall or a watchtower. The word for city in Hebrew has in its root understanding the sense of keeping an eye out, being watchful. In fact, the word for the angelic beings called watchers later is pretty much the same word. He can no longer work the ground, so he has to depend upon trading with other people for the things that he needs. And so having a central place to do that is going to be important. And that really is one of the purposes for the development of a city, is a central place where peoples can trade back and forth goods. So he builds the city and he names it after his firstborn son. Now the building of the city probably happened after he and his wife had many children and had other relatives that had moved into the region nearby. And then he names this city that he's built after that firstborn son. Then we see the genealogical list of his descendants. Now, this whole line is eradicated in the flood. So it is put here as a source of where certain technologies got their start in the history of the world. And this is the history of the pre-flood world. Verse number 18, to Enoch was born Irad. Irad fathered Mahuyael. Mahuyael fathered Methushael. Methushael fathered Lamech. And so this list has the first names that we really come across in the expanse of humanity. And each one of them have some meaning in the Hebrew language. For example, Irad seems to mean donkey. Mahuyael means to be struck by God, because El is the generic term for God. Methushael is a question. Who is of El? So who's on El's side? And then the guy that we really want to talk about now is Lamech, whose name seems to have something to do with education, with training, for gathering information. He is the seventh generation from creation in the Cain line. And it says in verse 19 that Lamech took two wives. Now, we're not guaranteed that this is the beginning of polygamy, that is, multiple partner marriage, but it is certainly the first record in the divine scripture of polygamy, which was not intended by God. Remember, God's design was one man with one woman for a lifetime. When you start adding other ideas of marriage, you're going to have problems. And we will see a very good example of the problems of polygamy when we go through the life of Jacob later. Now, keep in mind that while God did not have in his design these things, he does not intervene to stop it from happening. Because as we've talked about before, God gave to us free will. And he seems to honor that gift of free will, even when we use it to our detriment. And he tends not to intervene in history, in human events, unless, it would appear, there's going to be some sort of radical disruption of his plan for the salvation of mankind. And I think that's a principle that we need to acknowledge even in our modern times. Why does God allow bad things to happen? Because if he intervened all the time, that wouldn't allow for free will. I know that's frustrating, but think about your own relationship with your parents. How well did you take it when they kept meddling in every single choice of your life, even into your adulthood? No, you didn't take it very well. Even if they meant well, you still were frustrated by it because you didn't feel that it was allowing you to be your person, your individual. So God, as a good parent, although to our shame, allows us to make bad choices and reap the consequences of them. So Lamech took two wives. Bad idea. The name of the one was Adah. The name of the other was Zillah. Adah bore Yabel, which is a Hebrew word that has something to do with a stream. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. So this guy seems to have taken the concept of shepherding to a different level. Instead of shepherding only in one spot, move all over the place, be a far-ranging Bedouin with your animals. And we still see Bedouins in certain places of the world to this date. Verse number 21, his brother's name was Yubel. And it's, again, apparently the word means stream. You can tell that they are poetically related. It's possible that they were twins. It's interesting, in the Bible, we have a lot of twin stories, and I count this as being one of them. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. So somehow he is instrumental in instruments, the creation of musical implements, such as the stringed instruments and the woodwinds. Now, Zila also bore Tubal-Cain. Now, Tubal is poetically related to Yabel and Yubel, but it has more to do with the ancestor Cain, because the name, let me pull it up out of my notes here, the name has something to do with you are brought out of Cain. So it's a reminder of their heritage. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. So we have metallurgy showing up here in the eighth generation after the flood in this particular line. Now, they might have had some form of it previous to this, but now it's being really organized and structured by this individual. Now, all of this technology will apparently be available to the final generation that goes into the Ark. And it will be implemented in the New World. Or, as a secondary possibility, it will have to be rediscovered. But this is the beginning of these particular human occupations. The sister of Tubal-Cain was Ne'emah, and that becomes a popular name in later times as well. It has to do with loveliness. Now, Lamech betrays his own bad attitude in the next part of the story. Verse 23, Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, listen, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. So he comes home apparently after a really bad day, doing whatever it was he did, and he has killed someone. The word is generic for slaying, for ending the life of, but I wonder whether or not it actually was premeditated murder. Because he talks about the reason why he did it. He felt that this person, a young man by their standards, had somehow hit him and hurt him. And so he struck back and killed the guy. And of course, the expectation would be that that man's family would want to get even. And so Lamech's response is, let them try, because it's going to be bad if they do. Verse 24, if Cain's revenge is sevenfold, and you remember that goes back to when Cain said, this is a tough judgment that you're handing to me, God. I'm going to be hunted down by my relatives. They'll want to kill me for what I've done. And God's response is, no, I will mark you in a very specific way, and anyone who kills you will himself be judged sevenfold, which is probably kind of an idiomatic way of saying an absolute reprisal. There will be judgment, because seven is the number of completeness, 7 days in a week. Well, he, Lamech, says, if Cain had this threat hanging over him that anybody that hurt him or killed him was going to be judged seven times over, then Lamech's is 77-fold. So he exponentially increases it. He adds to it immensely. And it is kind of a threat, I think, to anyone that would even think about trying to take him down. Interestingly enough, the wording here in the Greek Old Testament parallels perfectly the wording in Matthew 18:22, where the discussion was about forgiveness. And Jesus is talking to his apostles and telling them that they needed to forgive and to be generous in their forgiveness to those that are repenting. And Peter says something along the lines of, so if my brother comes to me seven times in a day and asks for forgiveness, and I forgive him seven times, is that all I'm required to do? That's kind of the implication of his question. So if seven times I've forgiven him, can I then really get vengeance on him and knock him out in that eighth time that he tries this? And Jesus' response was, not just seven times, but 77 times. Meaning, no, Peter, you don't put limitations on this. You need to be open in your forgiveness. And the reason, of course, is that God is open in our forgiveness. Every time we sin, we can come to him and know that our truly repentant heart will find a God wanting to repair the relationship. And that is good news. So I just wanted you to see kind of the language parallel in the New Testament. Now let's set up for our story tomorrow by shifting to a different line. Verse 25 says, Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Sheth, or as we have in our English, Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. A couple of things we can gather from this. First of all, the name. The name Sheth means appointed, and it's related to what Eve says. She says, now that Abel is dead, God has given me another child to replace him. And this tells us that the Cain-Abel story happened immediately prior to the birth of Abel. Now, why is that important? Because chronologically, the book of Genesis tells us when Seth was born. We'll get to that later in our journey. The numbers for the birth of the birth of Seth vary between what is called the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and the Masoretic text, which is the Hebrew text that most Bibles are based on nowadays, but which is ironically a newer understanding of the Hebrew text than the one that was behind the Septuagint. And why is that important? Because in my estimation, I think the Septuagint represents the proper numbers when we go through this story. That over time, those numbers were somehow manipulated or deteriorated under the hands of later scribes, and that the Masoretic text has the less perfect representation of the original. And so in your Bibles, more than likely, you will see the numbers of the Masoretic text represented. And it says that Seth was born in the 130th year of Adam and Eve's existence. But the Septuagint says that he was born in the 230th year of Adam and Eve's existence. And I think that's the more probable one. So the story we just read happened 230 years after creation. So there would have been a pretty good-sized population. And that population was starting to spread out from the community that sprang up at the gate of Eden. So verse 26 says, to Seth also a son was born. So he's now grown up. And based on what we know for the timing of his birth, we're talking about more than 300 years after creation. To Seth also a son was born. He called his name Enosh, which is a word that means mortal, I think. The text goes on to say, at that time, people began to call upon the name of he who is. Now, the phrasing is not about people generically. It is, at that time, he began to call upon the name of he who is. I'll develop this a little bit more in tomorrow's lesson, but effectively, as the population spreads farther out into creation, it's not as convenient now to come to the gate of Eden to worship. And so people like Enosh, who is living farther away, develop a different approach or a different standard or pattern or religion in how they relate to he who is, relate to the Creator God. And that is building an altar and calling upon his name where that altar is established.